Pat Woese, welcome to the show. How are you, man?
Good, man. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very glad to have you. I have a couple of questions for you, and I know you've got a lot to share, so I wouldn't be surprised if we wouldn't be just limited at the questions I have and we splinter down a couple of threads. So first of all, how are you generally? What's happening in your life right now?
Good, man. I'm living out in Florida now and living the remote life, working on Starter Story full time and trying to grow, trying to build it.
I see. I've noticed at one point, because I follow you on Twitter and I see your progress, I saw that at one point you moved from New York City, was it, to Florida?
Well, after I when I first started indie hacking, I started it when I had a full-time job in New York City, and then eventually made some money, or started making some money, and I decided to quit my job and go become a digital nomad. And so then this is before COVID and all that, but I went to, Thailand and Bali and all these places. I was only making like, a few $1,000 a month. And I was like, well, I can't live in New York City anymore. I might as well go and try to, make this digital nomad thing happen. So I did that for, I did it for about 9, 10 months. And then I realized that I didn't really like that lifestyle too much, like traveling too much. And so I made it back to the US, and then COVID happened. And then I made it back to New York after that. And then I met my girlfriend, and she lives in Florida. So I moved down to Florida for that reason. But I'm loving Florida now.
Oh, that's lovely. Because I've noticed when you posted that tweet, letting us, I guess, the audience know about the move, you also mentioned a couple of benefits. But it looks like it aligned with your lifestyle design, which is a topic I wanna touch upon a bit later. But yeah, are you ever considering moving to another place, or is it further till you die, or is it just a big question mark for now?
Yeah, no, I'm, I didn't move to Miami like everyone else did. So I live on the western side of Florida. So for me, I guess I kind of realized that, I lived in a lot of places and I traveled a lot, and I guess I kind of realized that it doesn't really matter where you live, like to be in, to be in New York City or to be in Miami or whatever. It doesn't really contribute much to, your success or your happiness or whatever. So, I think just I chose to live here because of, my people and my girlfriend. And you can run a business and build a business anywhere now. So it doesn't really matter. That's I don't know if that answers your question, but
No, it does. And it's not a very answerable question to the point where you could give me a bullet point list of this was the list of pros and the cons, and this is why I've done it. But yeah, moving on from that. The main thing I have on my mind is I want to ask you about, I can't find a better word than the buzzword of storytelling, but let me explain to you what I mean. So I was just a few hours before we started this, I was just filling up the I was doing the interview for a Starter Story, and I have to compliment you on that. You've got a very nice process there. I can see it's been perfected over time. And I just like your take on this. I guess your advice, but also for the people listening, of course. You've seen many stories. I'm not gonna even put out a number. You've written them, you've read them, you've listened to them, etc. What makes a great story? What tells the difference between a great story, something that, and by great, I want to define it by this, something that makes you say, you know what, I would read that again, or it just leaves you with a nice aftertaste, as opposed to one that I feel like people don't really look at stories and they say, you know, that sucks. They just don't feel anything. So let me define bad by that, by not having you feel anything after interacting with a story.
yeah, that's a great question. I think about that a lot, especially when I started Starter Story. I would see a lot of the stories that would resonate and that wouldn't resonate, and that was kind of like my job to pick, what people would love and what people wouldn't love. I would say that it's hard to answer that and succinctly, but I think transparency is obviously the biggest thing that will leave people resonated. If you can relate to your audience, relate to the reader, and tell them like the real story of like, this is what it was like in the first month of building this business. And this is like what I had to go through. And this is when I had one customer or no customers. This is when I pivoted, you know, five different times in 2 months. Because a lot of the business stories out there are just like, and that's the reason why I started Startup Stories. Like, you know, it's about, oh, this guy raised this $1 million and, you know, they have all these customers. And then you read that and you're like, well, I can't relate to this at all. This is like, you know, it's like almost like a press release. So I would say that like writing in general, and not even just stories or success stories, is about what I've seen works is if you can like talk to someone as if you were just like talking to your best friend and be like super, and not just transparency, but I guess vulnerability, that would be another way of saying that. It's like, to be vulnerable and to be honest.
That makes sense. Now, what about you personally? I'm guessing you've shared the story of Starter Story, repeating my words there. I'm guessing you shared that a couple of times. And here's what I want to touch upon with this. I've noticed this with other indie hackers as well, especially if they build in public or they're, you know, more vocal than others at sharing their story. After a certain point, it gets to you saying out, not a script, because I don't feel like we have a script really, but you keep on reiterating the same story and you're like, there we go again. Maybe not, I'm not saying this in a bad way. Sometimes when I have to say a story, I'm like, well, buckle up because the next 5 minutes I'll be on autopilot most of the time. Have you experienced that?
Are you saying that like a lot of the stories end up sounding the same from indie hackers or?
No. I mean, when you relate the story of Starter Story or anybody with their product, and you know, across a year, people ask you what you do, or maybe even in an interview, or maybe you do a video and then a written interview. So after a certain point, it's about the same story and it feels repetitive. Have you ever had that feeling?
Yeah. You know, it's because I started, you know, it's been almost 5 years since I started now. It's not that it's the same story, but it feels like it's so long ago, like the early days, that it's hard to retell that story sometimes. I'm not like, one reason why I don't like do a lot of podcasts or even really do that well on podcasts is that I haven't like rehearsed like a good story about my story. And I don't think that my story is even all that interesting. It's like, kind of like, you know, I was just working a full-time job and I wanted to start something, and then, you know, kind of just slowly built up over time. And sometimes I forget about a lot of those details. And I think that like, maybe it's harder for audiences to relate nowadays because, you know, really it's not like exciting, like in the building phase, like it was when I first started. I do feel like that sometimes. Do you also feel that, or have you talked to other founders that say that?
I'll get back to this in a second because you've pointed exactly on what I wanted to touch, which is the fact that you might forget details. But you said you don't do well on podcasts. I feel like you have a very podcasty voice because you're very mellow and your words just seem to tie in together nicely.
Yeah, no, it's funny. One time I went on a podcast, a really big podcast, and then they canceled my whole interview because I wasn't prepped for it. And it was both sides, I think, that they didn't send me the questions like really late. And I don't know, that really bothered me ever since then that they canceled the interview. And
is it because you feel like you've invested your time and you came with all these things and just didn't amount?
No, I was more upset that because I didn't think that my story was interesting enough, even though, you know, the feedback that they gave me was that I didn't have like good answers for some of their questions. So I was like wondering like, okay, well maybe my story isn't interesting enough to be on, you know, this big of a pod, this mainstream. It was like a pretty mainstream podcast kind of, so I guess I don't like, sometimes I'll hear people on podcasts, I'll listen to some other, you know, successful entrepreneurs, and you kind of do hear that same story over and over again. And it feels like sometimes it's almost like made up. And I think a lot of like founders actually do this, is they'll go and kind of retell their story and the most interesting parts, and that's fine that they do that, that resonate the most with audiences because it is a form of marketing, right? So
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I don't know about podcasts, and I mean this one, what you mentioned, the one having being mainstream, maybe they had like a script or like an agenda, but I feel like the podcasts I enjoy the most are where it feels like the two people talking. They don't have to literally know each other, but the chemistry they have is as if they knew each other from before, or it just flows. It's just a conversation you enjoy listening to. That's why even when I invite you, I said something along the lines of you're ready as you are. You don't need to prepare anything because I'm not gonna ask you something I need to rehearse for because that wouldn't really be. If I would do that, it wouldn't lead to a natural conversation. But maybe I just have this approach and other people have another approach and nobody's wrong.
No, I agree with you 100%. Like more like Joe Rogan. This is like this podcast, you wouldn't like it. It was like highly produced, and the guest or the I guess the interviewer, there was two different interviewers, and they I don't think they knew that much about entrepreneurship. It was like, it was one of those media podcasts that are
That makes
all on the
sense.
top of iTunes. It's kind of mainstream, but
That makes sense. One thing you said is the fact that when you retell the story, you feel like you might forget the details. And that's exactly the feeling I had. So I felt anxious when I was writing the story on Starter Story because I was thinking, I'm re-saying the story, but it says here a couple of paragraphs. So I need to be, to be. Target, what's the word? I don't want to use too many words. That's what I was thinking. But then, how do I know whether I'm putting out the details that are actually worth it? And what if my story is actually a 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10? But because I'm forgetting those details, it's a 5 out of 10. On and anyways, it was mind chatter. It was my mind going crazy. Have you found any antidote to that, or are you still looking for a solution?
I guess I try to think about it as like whoever's going to read that story, what would be, whether the question was about launching your business or maybe it was about building the product itself. Is like if someone were reading this, imagine that they are in that exact phase of their business and they want like, when you think about it, like maybe you do like a tweet, a launch tweet. Like you could just say like, oh, I just created a launch tweet. Or you could be like, these are the elements of the tweet and why it works so well. Because someone who's reading that is like, okay, I want to do a big launch tweet and I want to get a bunch of likes and retweets and stuff. How can I actually make that useful? And I think when people see that, that's when they get like true value out of it. And that's what I've always tried to do with our starter story interviews is like, instead of being super, just like, oh, I just did SEO, or we worked on SEO for 6 months. It's like, oh, what articles did you launch? And like, what are the five things that you learned about SEO that you would tell someone who's just starting out? That's the kind of stuff that is like not covered in like most entrepreneurial contents in general. It's usually like, targeted towards a mainstream audience that maybe that hasn't built a business or doesn't even plan to. I don't know if that answers your question, but
It does. It's about, I mean, it is a constant thing, and I don't think there's a moment where you say, ah, this is it. But what about your internal feelings when you, let me explain a bit. So you might feel like you're re-saying the same, you're retelling the same story, but it's like you can't let a shiny object syndrome install within you where you're just looking for this. So a part of me wants to keep saying new stories and doesn't want to repeat the same stories, but I need to keep myself in check because otherwise I might get the shiny object syndrome when it comes to stories or when it comes to relating what happened. Or maybe this is not where I excel or you as well, since you have the same thing about telling people what happened over and over again, even though other people can do it and they just hammer home the same concept, and good for them, that's their marketing. So what's your take on this kind of problem?
So kind of what you're saying is like you're worried about saying the same thing over and over again. You feel like you need to have something like new and fresh with every time you retell your story.
I can do it, kind of, yes, I can do it, but I don't get the kick when I say the same story. Maybe the second time I can still do it, third time, fourth time, is not making me tick. And yeah. I don't feel like that's wrong. I feel like it would be wrong if I would only be able to say it once and never again. But that said, maybe I need to keep myself in check even more, or maybe it is just part of me. What's your feeling on this?
Yeah, I think that's a really common thing that people experience. It's something that I also, like, when I first created Starter Story, we have, like, you know, all these new stories. I always feel like I have to have, like, new content, new fresh content. Like, if I send something to our email list, is a good example. Like, I, you know, we have this idea that it always has to be new and fresh and super interesting. But, like, you have to remember that most people that are reading that or that are consuming that, they don't know your backstory. They don't know the beginnings. And you can go, like, for example, if we will go and send something on our newsletter that is like a piece of content that's 2 years old. Yeah, sure. Some people have seen it, but if it's a really good piece of content, it's really valuable. It's probably better to send that old thing than something new just for the fact that it's new. So I guess, you know, we think when we share stuff that people who are reading it know so much about us. They know our backstory. They know every interview we've done or every, everything about us. When in reality, they probably don't know. They might know a little bit about you, but they don't know a lot of, you know, different stuff. They don't know everything. So it's okay to kind of say the same stories over and over again. I think that's what most, entrepreneurs do well, is actually they tell a really good story over and over again.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And that's something that I personally go through with, like, I've been, like, not tweeting as much or writing as much over the past years or so, because not for that reason, but, you know, I always feel like I have to have something new and interesting to say. Otherwise, you know, it doesn't feel like it's worth it to me, because I have those same feelings that, you know, I'd be just reiterating myself, and I don't like the idea of having to say the same thing over and over again.
So is it kind of like business where you have to balance? I mean, maybe earlier on you have to put more weight into what the customer wants, needs, etc., but balance that with yourself as well, because after a certain point there might not be any more of yourself. I mean, I'm exaggerating here, but what I'm saying is, if it literally kills you to say the same story all over again and you're on your 17th reiteration, at one point you might say to yourself, fuck this, screw this, I'm not saying it anymore. So
yeah,
that's not good either, if it's at the expense of yourself. Is it about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good, like, it brings up a really good point, is that, like, we're building a business. We're not, most of us are building businesses. We're not building personal brands. Like, we kind of are a little bit, but how much time are you going to spend on the personal brand and telling the story, and how much time are you going to spend on the business? And that's something that I've kind of thought about a lot over the years, is like, you know, we see a lot of these people online that do a really, like, amazing jobs of telling their personal brands, but most of that is, or a lot of times, their brand is so tied to their business that it makes sense for them to do that. But mm-hmm. for most of us, we're trying to build just like a SaaS app that doesn't really rely on a personal brand, or, you know, most businesses don't, personal brands don't matter. That, yeah, you kind of have to just, yeah, be okay with, you know, if that's what you want to do, if that you want to, you know, have that personal brand and really put that, you know, 20, 30 hours a week into new content and retelling your story in new ways and spending time on that, then you should. But most of us, at least something that I learned in the past few years, is that in order to grow my business, I need to focus more on the business and less on the, you know, personal brand stuff.
Mm-hmm. I've actually heard, do you know Fathom Analytics, Paul and Jack? Have you heard of them?
Yep.
Yeah. I've heard them on their podcast going through. I mean, they were actually recapping the cycles, the stages they were going through, because they needed to separate Paul Jarvis's personal brand from Fathom, because Jack was saying, it's great, but it's not a good long-term strategy to rely on Paul's personal brand. And they even gotten to a point where they not really killed, but Paul deleted his Twitter. And guess what? The business didn't die because they made these few steps. So it's for anyone listening to this, needing a direct example of what Pat was talking about, go look into, I think they're, podcast is called Overboard, but anyways, Fathom Analytics. Yeah. What do you think of them? Have you followed their story by any chance?
That's actually interesting. I didn't know that story behind it, that they actually intentionally did that. But I remember that he was like a pretty, you know, I've been doing indie hacking, whatever you want to call it, building startups for the last 5-6 years almost now. And I remember that he was like a pretty big name in the space. Like he had launched a book and I think he was doing courses or something like that, or some sort of info products. And then I never really saw much from him after that. So that makes sense, actually. And I like that. I think that's really cool that they did that intentionally.
I apologize. It's called Above Board. And I wanted to link to people the exact episode. It's called Paul Quit the Internet ... again. And this is where they go through the decision of deleting the podcast deleting the Twitter account and everything. But anyway, leaving these guys behind, look them up if it sounds interesting. So tell us the story of Starter Story. I'm joking. I won't get into that. I'm pretty sure you've had to say it a couple of times on podcast too, not just in writing. I've seen on your Twitter that in your bio, and I believe you talked about this before, that your goal is to reach 1 billion people, inspire 1 billion people who want to start their own business. You have a very neat page on Starter Story, but again, in your bio as well, where you have a live counter of how many unique individuals. Is that just unique users on starterstory.com?
Yeah, that's pulling from Google Analytics, all-time users.
All right. And at the moment, you are at about 13 million, a bit above that. Where did that come from? And if I had to guess, I'm sorry for leading the question, but I'm not really that sorry because I'm really curious if that's the case. I'm guessing it was a matter of what got you here won't take you there. Mm-hmm. And you needing to tap into the next level of whatever would inspire you. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
There's a story behind it, kind of, which I'll try to tell. But when I first started indie hacking, building startups, whatever, I was working a full-time job. I had like 50,000 in student debt. I wasn't very financially secure at all. And I read this book called Think and Grow Rich. Most people know that, right? Napoleon Hill, where you write, basically my takeaway from it was I wrote a piece of paper that said, I'm going to have in 3 years, I think maybe 2 or 3 years, I'm going to have $10,000 of net worth. And that time I had like negative 50,000 with all my debt and credit card debt and all this stuff. And I'm going to do it by, you know, indie hacking and building a business and paying, you know, living frugally and that sort of thing. And then I reached that goal. After like, you know, a lot of weird things happened, it wasn't exactly in the way that I reached it. The plan that I set wasn't exactly the way that I got there, but I got there and I got out of debt and I had some money. And that was the point where I quit my full-time job, because that was the first time that I had any sort of like financial independence, which sounds crazy now to say that it was like $10,000 at the time, but that to me, that was like crazy. And then I set another goal, which was to get Starter Story to like, at that point that I reached the goal, I set another goal about 2.5 years later, which was to have a certain amount of net worth and also have Starter Story hit like $30,000 or $40,000 in MRR. And then I reached that goal, said, create another piece of paper and wrote that down. So that's the next goal that I wrote. Because I reached it earlier or a few months ago, I said, well, I want to set a new ambitious goal. And like you said, what got you here won't get you there. But I didn't want this goal to be about my own personal net worth or like, I wanted it to be more about the business that I'm building. Because again, like I said, I'm more focused on the business than the personal brand and that sort of thing. I really do want to challenge myself and my team and everything to do something a lot bigger. So I did set that goal to reach a billion, basically, visitors on the website, unique visitors on the website by 2025. So set that 3 years out, and then I'm not exactly sure I'm going to get there, but that's the goal.
That makes sense. Any specific reason why you've chosen a billion? Was it just that it looked like a challenging thing that would make you say, you know, this is a not impossible, but highly, but probable, sorry, not impossible, but doable goal that I can reach?
No, I think it sounded so out of reach that it was worth going for, you know?
Yeah.
There's no like, you know, sometimes you'll like, it's a reality check. Sometimes I'll go and look at like, for example, like some YouTuber that is 18 years old and has, you know, you can look at how many views they have on their videos, mm-hmm. and it's like 6 billion. And I'm like, oh, okay, so if this kid can do that, then I think that we could probably get to like something like that too.
So. That makes sense. Because the thinking, the human mind doesn't really think in exponential terms. And I mean, it's quite hard because if you're not reaching exponential terms, you're not reaching it at all, which we tend to think in linear terms. But yeah, it sounds like the kind of goal that would pull the best out of you. And I'm asking you, is this the point of it, a billion? Because I'm pretty sure that if you get to 900 million, you'll still be like, well, you know, we'll be reaching a billion in a couple of months from now, in January 2025. Was that the point of it, to pull the best out of you?
Yeah, I think so. I think really it's going to have to pull the best out of me. It's going to have to make me go deep and really rethink how to do things. Like, you know, I think last year we like 10x'd traffic over the course of a year. And that was because we were just trying different things and we found something that worked. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if we keep doing that strategy, it won't get us to a billion. We have to keep rethinking and redoing. I think, and also what's so important about that is like putting it on my Twitter bio, and I still actually need to do a better job of like, I write more about that and share more that's my goal. But putting it out to the world and saying that's what I'm trying to do will force us to actually figure out how to get there. Otherwise, I would just be, you know, coasting. I don't know. That's what worked for me over the past few years to set a really ambitious goal. Maybe it won't work this time, but it's something that I think about every day. And I have a little piece of paper up on my wall. So I look at it. I try to, you know, just remember that it's there and that's the goal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, two, 3 years is a long time. So who knows what could happen.
I'll be following the journey. The reason why I'm asking you this is because it becomes clear to me that there are stages and stages. And obviously it's something that you hear everywhere, but the more you look into people's stories, the more you talk to them, which is why we're doing here, or listening to them, if you're a beloved member of the audience of this podcast, the more you see patterns, but to maybe place people in buckets, or situations, I should say, in buckets. And for some people, it comes natural to get over the stage where they're just trying to put some money together to maybe buy their time, or maybe it's even behind that. Maybe it's just a matter of putting food on the table. And as I said, for some people, it comes natural to get to the next level without any friction. For others, they need to go for a bit of friction, but they also rebound. And part of one of the patterns I'm noticing is the fact that once people buy back their time, they kind of need more of a maybe long-term goal, maybe ambitious target, maybe like the money aspect doesn't motivate them anymore. And it's you know, no wonder. And this assumes they started with that. I took the liberty of talking about it because you talked about your college debt and how this got you started. Was there any friction for you when you switched between these modes? Should I call them modes? How'd you look at them?
You're saying that, well, I guess what I think about is like when you, I think there's a Naval quote about it, is like when you get a taste of freedom, you'll never be able to go back or something like that. Yeah, I think that's like some people, like, for example, my parents, like, you know, they never really truly owned their time. And growing up, I never like really knew like any entrepreneurs or anything like that. But I think what is like one of the greatest, I'm very lucky and grateful that I got to have a taste of that, of that feeling of being able to wake up in the morning and work on whatever you want to work on, and know that you know, some people are running around all day and don't have a moment to even take a breath, you know? I don't know. I think that's like something that if you can experience or like and see if it's something that you like or whatever, if you can experience that as early as possible in your life, financial freedom and owning your own time, that is like, it is a super powerful thing that just inspires me to know that it's possible that I could, you know, earn my own money through my own actions and never have to work for someone again. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's going on a bit of a tangent there, but
no, that's okay. It's I come to you with a billion questions at the same time, so I also keep track of the questions I ask you, so I'll get back to it. What about friction when you changed your target or when your motivation changed? Or was there a motivation change? I need to actually start with that.
Friction when I initially set that goal?
Yeah, and I'll give you a classic example. And many people open up about this more and more these days, which I think is a great thing. Initially, they were motivated by money because they had to put some food on the table. And then it was still money because they wanted to buy back their time. But then doing more of the same didn't help them because they kept working like they had a fire under their ass, which is, by the way, my situation as well. I've been through this. I kept working like I had a fire under my ass, but I knew at the back of my head that I had 6 digits in the bank account as cushion, as backup. So no matter how hard I tried playing that theatric thing of, like back in the day, even though it wasn't that long ago, it wasn't the same thing. So I had to switch the MO, the way of approaching things.
What was your switch?
Yeah. But and to answer your question, some friction meant a bit of, I guess they call it burnout, or a bit of rethinking, or a bit of, you know what, this actually doesn't work. What the fuck is going on? Have you experienced any of that, or was it just smooth transition?
I think my story is, I don't know, maybe a little different because after I graduated college, I went and tried to figure out what I wanted to do in life. And I didn't know that it was starting a business or building products or building businesses. I actually went through like 3 different careers in the course of like 5 or 6 years. So I started out doing accounting, and then I went into finance, and then I went into software engineering. And I moved through those so quickly because I realized that like, is something that excited me in the beginning. And this, I'm the type of person that tries a lot of different things. And I thought that is what I wanted to do. And then I would like get like decent at it and then get bored and find another career. And so I went on into finance, and I went on and did software engineering, and then became a software engineer. And then I realized that it was not that it was boring. I also just hated the idea of working for someone else. And like, I just couldn't see like a future of me being, you know, a software engineer for 20 years. It just didn't like seem like something that I, you know, wanted to do once I got the hang of it, and the challenge was kind of sort of gone. So for me, it was always, I knew right away when I started building products and launching products and growing businesses, that was something that was the reason why I did it. And that's the reason why I built it. And it was never like, obviously the money is nice and all that, but that was always like, I guess I started doing it and I started building products while I had a full-time job, and I didn't know that it was going to be a business in the future. I just kind of wanted to maybe like one day have earned some money through building products. And that was like, that was so exciting in and of itself to build stuff and launch it. And like, basically the idea of having like building something and having people use it, that was the coolest thing for me. Mm-hmm. It, like, I think it's maybe the indie hacker scene's a little bit different now. A lot of it is about, a lot of stuff I hear is like, you know, building a product and making a lifestyle out of your income. But this is kind of back in like, I don't know, maybe like more of the Product Hunt days where it was just like cool to have a Product Hunt launch and like have thousands of people use your thing. You don't make any money. Mm-hmm. That was the coolest thing for me, that I could build something and have people around the world use it. And that kind of turned into a business, I guess. But that was what really motivated me in the beginning. So that again, probably doesn't answer your question, but that
does,
was always
it does. Because it means I assume wrongly your initial motivations, or motivation sounds like it's got like an interior motive. I guess a better word would be drive. Because see, now it makes sense. When you had this drive, now that I understand it, things like there wasn't any need for any friction because there was nothing to bump your head against the wall, anything like that. Uh-huh. Okay. So walk me a bit more, if you will, about the Product Hunt days. So that era, because you're right, these days is more about what you said and the MRR or the multiples you might be getting, or I guess other metrics. I don't think they're right or wrong, but other metrics. How was it back then? And this is what, 2017, 2016?
Yeah. Late 2017. Okay. Yeah. So it's funny that I think about it now. It's probably like I was really just looking for validation from the world that I could build anything, because before that, me and a few friends, while we had full-time jobs, we tried to start a startup, like a YC startup. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is before the indie hacker days. You know, we were living in San Francisco at the time, and we were trying to build a SaaS product. And you know, we got our YC interview, and like again, I found the process of just like building, like that was the most fun part, and that's why I got super hooked to it. Like, you know, we were in our living room on this big table, and we were hacking away at this MVP for 2 or 3 months, and we didn't get any customers or anything like that. And the product, long story short, the product ended up failing. So after that, I was like, okay, well, maybe I can go and build my own business, or just build something that's valuable to the world and launch it on Product Hunt. And you know, it took another 3, 4, 5 months to do that, and like launched it on Product Hunt. I think it only got like 100 or 200 upvotes or something like that. And then Ryan Hoover, the founder of Product Hunt, like commented on it and said like, this is awesome. And like, that was like the best moment. I remember I took the whole day off of work and just like pretended I was sick or something like that, so I could do my Product Hunt launch. Cause you know, you had to wake up at like 3 a.m. or whatever. And I remember just like got featured, made the front page. Maybe I was like the top 3 or top 5 product of the day. And I was just like jumping around in my room, like just like it was the best ever. And I didn't, it was not making any money. And it just seemed like at the moment, it seemed like the biggest thing in the world, you know, because I had, you know, 1,000 people visit my website on Google Analytics and seeing all that go up, and people telling you that you built something useful, like send you an email like, oh, I like this, this is awesome or whatever. That was like, I guess it was kind of the validation that I could build something useful. And that felt like more valuable than anything that I had done before in terms of like work, like stuff that I had worked on in my career. You know, I never like had thousands of people use it, right? It didn't impact thousands of people or it wasn't something that I personally made. So that was the most exciting part for me.
Do you think that was lovely, by the way, you describing this package of emotions? Do you think because as I said, the metrics these days are a bit different. Like people are aiming for something. I mean, let's be honest, it's only been 5 years, 6 years, like it's been decades, but priorities change, or the hot metrics are different, and that's also a sign of the industry maturing. But I'm digressing here. Do you think we've lost our way, quote unquote, or is it just a normal thing to have these things, this North Stars change?
What do you think is the North Star these days? Is it like MRO?
Well, if I want to be reductionist, yes, and I do want to be, because I was a couple of minutes ago and I said it's MRR, but upon on a further look, maybe it's the multiples. And I'll tell you why. I feel like as a SaaS bootstrap founder or as a startup founder, I've noticed in people that they're happy to know that they have the option of selling at this multiple and at this amount of money. They don't need to capitalize on it. They just need to know it's down there. It's available. And even if they have no interest to sell, it's still a comfort, which fair point, because you can always sell. So I would say that because it used to be valuation back in the day, right? In the TechCrunch era. Or maybe in the about the same time, but that meant you're waiting for a big company to acquire you, and you know that's a bit of a more. It involves more praying than it does right now at the multiple you're getting or the valuation, this kind of valuation. So yeah, that will be my answer.
No, I think that's really interesting. I never thought about it like that, but I think that's cool. I think like again, that goes back to the financial security thing. It's like, I built something that makes money, and if I want, I could sell it. And that's something that probably, yeah, that's something I think about too. And yeah, I don't know if that's like, I guess I never thought about it like that, but you know, back in the day there, and I hate to be like the back in the day guy, but indie hacker businesses were not selling they were not worth anything, you know, like there was no micro acquire or whatever. And like to hear that someone would get acquired, but it would usually be behind the scenes. You wouldn't hear about it, or it'd be an acqui-hire. A lot of these companies that go and buy these small businesses, that's pretty new as far as I know. I think, I mean, I actually just interviewed one of those PE firms that buys indie hacker startups, and you know, they bought their first startup, I think in like 2016 or 2017. And they found that it was actually something that works. And I think they have those new, what are they called? Like Calm Capital and what's the Rob Walling one?
Tiny Seed. Yeah.
Yeah. Those didn't exist back then either. So it was like, I guess, yeah, when I started, it was less about the valuation, but there was the whole thing about, you know, having a lifestyle. I hate the word lifestyle business, but like making income from your products, that was always something that I really thought like maybe one day I could have that. For right now, I'm just trying to build, or back then I was thinking, for right now, I'm just trying to get some people to visit my thing, and then I can figure out how to make money off of it later. Like Peter Levels was a big inspiration for me at the time and still is. Yeah, there wasn't so much about the valuation of your business, but I think that's cool now.
Something highly relevant was, and I smile when you mentioned Peter Levels because I was going to bring him up, is I've seen the tweet as well, but when I researched you for the podcast, I mean, it didn't need too much researching because I was following the story, but doing my recap, one of the last things you've retweeted is the fact that Peter made a public P&L statement for one of his products, Nomad List, and he says the following in the tweet: acquirers always ask for P&L statements, profit and loss statements, and it's so tiring to make them, so I automated with PHP. A live P&L statement for the last 365 days rolling, updated every second, and the link. If this was posted in 2016 or 2015, people would have been like, so what? Who cares about numbers, black on white, whatever? Show us the product. But these days, people, and I see some activity on the tweet, and I know that the sentiment is more like, ooh, are you looking to sell? Are you about to sell? Do you just entertain offers? How much is it? 800K? Let me do that times 4.5 or what about 3.5? So these are the kind of discussions people have these days. And I was, it's this that I'm looking at when I come up with the answer I gave earlier, which is my take on what the metrics are these days. So maybe Peter isn't even looking to sell unless there's a big multiple. Perhaps, I don't know, I guess I'll have to ask him. But this is, you know, sometimes people look at builders, indie hackers, and they are part of the story, such as I'm with you. And I like to put myself in your shoes and say, what would I do here? Because whatever, I'm living through you a bit. And that's what inspires me. By the way, does that happen to you as well? This, what I just said, living for others and having that as an inspiration?
Yeah. I think Peter Levels is a great example. It's like, for the fact that him and some other people pioneered that open startup movement, which was the most amazing thing that I think, and the most inspiring thing for me, is that you could see, and this is the difference between maybe a few years before where it wasn't happening. It's like, you can see that someone, as long as you believe them, you can see that someone is making $10,000 a month off of some small business that anyone can build, right? Like some online business, not some big startup. It's like an online business. This person did it, and then there's a few other people that did it, and they're sharing how much they're making, and it doesn't seem like it's a scam, and I'm trying to sell you a course or something like that. And just this is the reason why, one of the biggest reasons why I started Starter Story, is the fact that you can just see that information online. That, and this seems like so simple now and like obvious now, was the motivation for me to see that it's possible, like to have a business that makes money and has, you know, impact on the world. And you can see all those metrics and, you know, right on the screen, and you realize that it's possible to do that. I think we kind of all take that for granted now, that we can see those things with the internet. But for me, that was like the first time that I had seen that that's possible. Cause like typically you read like startup stories on TechCrunch and that sort of thing. It's like, we raised this much money, and you know, it doesn't really show like a realistic or relatable story. So I think that is like, the way that I was living through others was, before I started, obviously I was reading all those stories. I was reading Peter Levels' story and a bunch of other people's stories. And that inspired me to start, just because I wanted to have that lifestyle. I thought, and to realize that it was something that was actually attainable, was like, you know, I think that is one of the reasons that I was able to make it work.
And you said something along the lines of, this is quite obvious now. I think it is for now, because we're very deep in the trenches or in the circles, but there are still so many more people that have yet to discover this. So you said Peter Levels pioneered this, but Pat, I'll be honest, I feel like and I'm rooting for you to reach that 1 billion number in terms of people reached, I feel like you'll be up there with the pioneers, given what Starter Story does, because it's like an article from 5 years ago can still help somebody today. It's not like a product hunt's one-off spike sort of thing. I feel like, especially if there's somebody who has a progress over the years on Starter Story. Do you have like repeat stories? So yeah. Let's say 5 years ago, 2 years ago, today?
Like updates on the business?
Yeah.
Or follow-ups? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We try to follow up with as many people every year and get, you know, what's been, you know, how much they've grown and like, what are the latest challenges and, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, do you know Nathan Latka?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you guys should team up something one day. Cause it's like, his product is complementary to you. It's like, you do the same thing. You have a bit of overlap, but not too much. Or I guess you have enough differentiation, even though you overlap with Starter Story and with his database of companies.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I've talked to him a few times just over Twitter and that sort of thing. I think he's super, super smart. And that guy works crazy hard. The amount of YouTube, or I guess his podcast. And I think he's a total hustler, man. I really respect him.
Yeah. I don't know how I've never spotted that you two are similar in some, your businesses actually are similar in some aspects, but will we ever see a collab or acquisition from any of you two?
Maybe, yeah. I should we've tried to set up some time to talk, but I've never like actually talked one-on-one with them. I think now he's doing like he has the SAS database, and then he also does funding. Is that right?
Yeah. It's one of these things where they give you 11 months of revenue today, and then you owe 12 months. So they call it something which sounds fancy, but it actually makes sense. Something like debt-free financing, if I'm not mistaken.
Did you take on any financing to build your business?
Myself, no. I'll get to this back in a second. Debt-free financing sounds very stupid. Anyways, equity-free. That's it. Raise money without giving away equity. That's what they say.
Debt-free. If you want $1,000 or
yeah. No, I've never raised any money, and I was just looking these days at. I went on a rabbit hole on. Do you know Republic or Ceders.com?
Republic, I know. I don't know the Ceders.
It's the same thing, and I think I was surprised they even acquired Republic acquired Ceders.com. It's exactly the same thing, or 95%. Anyways, I went down a rabbit hole of companies that got funded because I want to invest some money like that, and I was looking. Oh, look at this, you know, no code company that does this and this and isn't fantastically fanciful, but they raised $3 million across 6 months, so that's an option as well, and it's obviously a different kind of raise, but it's an option for people.
Yeah.
So, but then I asked myself, do I want to raise money? And I said, I don't have any specific plan for that. But yeah. What about you? Would you ever raise?
I've been thinking about it more. And actually, like a VC reached out to me. But then I realized that, yeah, like you said, like I probably don't have a good enough plan. And that's probably a bad thing. But at the same time, I have this like VC guy who asked me all these questions about my business. He's not invested in my business, but he asked me all these questions about it. And it reminds me that I don't want to have investors by the questions that he's asking. So it would be nice. I would say that it would be really nice to have $5 million in the bank that you can spend without worry. You know, you can just put it towards growth and like, as long as you're, you know, are somewhat careful with that money, it's a nice cushion. It probably feels really good, but that's also like a really scary track to go down, I think. And even just going into YC as well, is like you might think that you don't want to go raise more after, or that's all you need to raise. But once you get into that, hot seat. And, you know, you start hiring people and you start like, even just, I think what happens with YC people, you start being in that environment around other YC founders or around other founders who are doing things not the indie hacker way, that you just like, as humans, we like want to be like other people and we want to feel included and part of things, that you probably might go and raise a lot more money after that, or at least. You know, I heard this story actually about these guys. It was a really good article. Actually, they wrote, you might have seen it. It was probably on Hacker News, about how all the time it took to raise a seed round. I don't remember how much it was, or maybe it was a Series A. I can't remember. But I think they had to do over 200 meetings.
Shit.
And I'm not a meetings guy at all. Like I know I need to get better at that, and I'm working on that, but. You know, they did 200 meetings and got rejected over 100 times to raise a few million dollars.
Wow.
And I don't know, I can't justify that. Or it's not that I can't justify it, but I don't see myself being happy doing that.
It's not the game you want to play, is it?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Getting back to that's crazy, 200 meetings. The idea was
picking. Could be wrong about the number, but it was something like at least 200 or 300 hours, something like that.
Yeah. Shit. The idea of doing that with users makes me say, whoa. Because I'm guessing it's in a very compressed period of time. Because when you're fundraising, we're talking about a couple of weeks here. Even though I know what I just said isn't exactly words of wisdom, but it is the truth for me about having 200 meetings with the users in a couple of weeks. But something about, back to what you said about what I had to say when you mentioned you wouldn't raise money, I had the exact same answer, which is you're playing a completely different game then. And I feel like for both you and I, it's about the sort of business we want to build, because it's not a starter story. It doesn't have to be a all or nothing sort of deal. It might take longer, but you know you will get there, or you're doing everything you can to get there, but you don't put it on a timeline. You're not saying by 2025 I have to reach 1 billion users or else I'll have to shut down the business. No, you have reached whatever number that was, hundreds of millions, or maybe you were surpassed, that's who knows. And that's pretty much it. Life goes on. So yeah, that's another thing I wanted to add to this idea of like changing the game when you start raising money. Then I have to ask you, would you ever start a company that is an all-in sort of company, so all or nothing?
Yeah, maybe. So, you know, I like to think, and I'm a very impatient person, so I do a lot of writing and try to remind myself that it's a long game. You know, you want something to happen in the next year, but in reality, I love building businesses and companies and building products that I hope that I'll be doing it over the next 40 or 50 years. So, you know, maybe if Starter Story does have, you know, it reaches its point where I'm no longer, you know, maybe I sell it or, you know, whatever, maybe something in 10 years, maybe I'll be ready to build that business, to do that all in business, because only for the reason, because I don't want to do the same thing over and again. I would want another challenge. Hopefully I would be able to take my skills and my learnings from the past businesses, but build something different and build something new and challenging. So I think it sounds exciting and fun, to one day to do that, just to experience it. But yeah, I wouldn't do it now.
This ties in this. I like it when we go full circle, because this makes me think of what we said at the beginning of the discussion. Okay. So this is what you have on your plate right now. You said you're working on Starter Story full time. Mm-hmm. And do you never, ever get shiny object syndrome? Do you never, ever feel like, I could just start this thing on the side and surely it won't creep up and take some of my time? Ever have that?
Oh man, I'm luckily past that point, but you may have not seen, because before, this is another story that's probably worth telling. But when I started Starter Story, it was not the business that I thought that was going to be my full-time business. I said, the reason why I started, or I thought it would be because my previous failed startup, I was like, okay, well, if I could start a blog about entrepreneurship, then I could meet new entrepreneurs, see new product ideas, make connections. And then I could build my real business. Like I could build something, you know, I could find the real idea that I want to build. So in that time, I launched, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 products. And one of them I even went pretty much full time on for 1.5 years, which was a SaaS product that I actually decided to shut down last year because Starter Story was doing better than it. And I wasn't even putting any time into Starter Story.
Was it Pigeon?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I've learned my lessons of shiny object syndrome. I definitely had it. I had it the worst probably anyone has that could have it. So there's a lot of learnings there. Yeah.
Do you feel like, and I guess this is more about philosophy and how you see life, do you feel like this is the kind of mistake that people have to make by themselves to learn the pain? Or is it something that you can just hear Pat Woes on this podcast and you hear it in some other places when you say, well, okay, I won't be doing that, and you're being saved from the cost of making that mistake? What kind of mistake do you think it is?
No, you have to make that mistake on your own, at least for me. Some people are really smart and don't have to make the mistakes, can learn from others. I'm not one of those people, and I have to learn from my own experiences. And you know, I thought I was super smart and I could have multiple products and multiple successes. And I thought that my previous success of Starter Story, because it did pretty decent for, you know, pretty quickly, that I could just go and launch another business, Pigeon, and it would be successful just by using the same tools. And I thought I was better, or like I thought I was like good in, you know, I had what they call Dunning-Kruger syndrome, which is like you're so dumb and you don't even know it. And I don't have that syndrome, but I'm just saying that I had it in that moment that I thought I could build two businesses at the same time. I think it's really hard to build two businesses at the same time. And I think that is something that is, you have to learn. And when I see people that are launching multiple businesses, I would never tell them, don't do that, right? Like, I just see like, you will learn a lot from this process. And then you'll, and the best thing is you'll find the one that works out. And that's good. I think it's a good thing that people launch multiple businesses, because you get to see what you like and don't like. And it doesn't have to be this, you know, one has to be super successful in the beginning. It's okay to have a few things that work, and then to learn that lesson early is good.
Yeah. And I think it was Ray Dalio that taught me this. And obviously it's the sort of thing you keep hearing from everywhere, but sometimes somebody phrases in a certain way and you also respect their opinion in a different way, that it makes a better point. It is actually the pain of making these mistakes that keep you from redoing it again. So it is that package of negative feelings that you have about yourself, about the world, about the situation, probably if you're more enlightened, that are the guiding hand that keep you from redoing it again. So I like what you said about some people have to just go through this, and it is probably most people.
Is that your experience?
Yeah, I'm like you. I like to make mistakes. Sometimes I think of, give an example. We've made an acquisition recently. We've acquired a company, but it was more like it wasn't anything strategic with the other companies. It was more like an investment. We looked at real estate and at some other stuff, and we said, well, might as well do it here as well. And I remember I said, even if it's a mistake, I'm happy to go forward, because at what we'd be losing, which isn't crippling us, I would rather make this mistake now rather than later. So I know I've learned exactly what you said, that I prefer making mistakes so I can learn by nature and by the scar tissue, rather than read it up somewhere and just don't do it. And I want to ask you, because I can tell why that is for me, is because I know I'm very curious. So even if I read it up somewhere and just don't do it, my curiosity is going to eat me up from the inside, and I'm going to do it. So I wasted the time learning, quote unquote, and I'm still going to do it. Is that what makes you learn by making mistakes as well?
Yeah. I say the same thing. It's just, I have to know, and I have to have that little notch on my belt that it's something that I know. Like, I have to know. I can't just know that it is not the right thing to do. I have to know why it's not the right thing to do. And I have to have experienced why.
Yeah.
So that I can internalize that, and, you know, have that lead my other decisions that I make. So I'm just like you. It's like, I value the knowledge, the failure and the experience more so than maybe it's almost like having fear of missing out on that experience. Like, I want to, I'd rather try and fail than, you know, I don't care if I've, as long as I learn something, that's the only thing.
You're absolutely right. It is some FOMO. Now that you're saying it, I realize there is some FOMO that drives this. But if anybody's listening to this and you're the other type of person who prefers learning by reading and you just don't do the mistakes, please hit us up, either myself or Pat. We'd love to talk to you, to have somebody from the other side tell us what it's like, because I feel like it is part of who we are. Pat, what do you think? Is this something learned? Give me your nature versus nurture on this thing.
On what we're talking about, which is
learning like that.
I don't know. I think it's something that, some way that I've always been, is that I loved to try new things and new hobbies and new careers. As I said before, I had multiple new, you know, careers, and I think it's just a curiosity, and I think that's what makes for good entrepreneurs in the long run, is like lots of little weird habits and hobbies and getting interested in like really obscure things like different technologies or sports or, you know, reading weird books. And I think that's what makes for, you know, it's not what you hear about in the headlines or in on Twitter, but over the long run, that kind of like that curiosity is like, well, what else really can push people to like really continue to learn and level up in life? Like if I think about a lot of people that I know, you know, they kind of just do one thing for their whole life. And, you know, they, it's not that they're better or worse people, but I think that they're like a small subset of people. Like we think that, this is another thing I think about sometimes, like we think that everyone is like us because we run around in the same Twitter circles and we know everyone digitally. But if you just like go outside and like, I play a lot of tennis, so I meet a lot of random people and ask them what they do. And I don't know their whole stories obviously, but there's not a lot of people like me in Tampa, Florida right now, but there's a lot of people like me that are listening to this and that sort of thing. So I think that people like us are kind of unique. And that's what makes for like success and growth as a person over 40 and 50 years. You know, right now we're just pretty young guys, but when you see those guys that are like really successful billionaires, like Ray Dalio, like you said, those are guys that did that for 40 years. And then that's when it really pays off, I think.
Yeah. And to the point where they even, as far as I can tell, even get obsessed with something. And it's a healthy obsession. You can be obsessed about things that are bad for you or even harm others. Or apparently you can channel that obsession into something positive that quite the contrary doesn't hurt anyone. It's a win-win. It's a net positive for the world.
Yeah, I think getting obsessed with things is like a good sign for obviously not bad things, but like, you know, anything that is sports or books or whatever is like, most people aren't like that. And you think that they are like, I don't know, just reiterating what I said before is like, it's okay if you are like weirdly obsessed with stuff, with something. And,
you said earlier, and I've seen when you made the tweet about moving to Florida, you also mentioned tennis, and you just mentioned now. I wanted to ask you, what do you say when people ask you, so, oh, you're Pat, nice to meet you. What do you do for a living? What are you working?
Man, it's always been hard. That's one of the hardest things. I'm sure everyone else experiences that who's doing what we do. I used to say, I've said so many different things. Lately, I've been saying, telling people that I run a digital media company, which nobody would really understand what that is.
Yeah.
Or a lawyer or whatever. One guy I met told me that he just tells people that he's a hustler, which I like. I kind of like someone who just says like, I'm a hustler, I'm an entrepreneur. And then if they ask more, I wish I could be better at being more, I guess, like almost like confident in, you know, telling like random people what I do. Like I always like don't want to say anything and just let them talk because I don't really want to like, I know that they're probably not that all that interested. I can usually tell when someone's interested and I can run the conversation that way. If you ask someone who is a doctor, you know, what they do, they can easily say, oh, I'm a spinal surgeon and I do blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, that's awesome. I don't have a version of that. So.
Are you saying that because with a spine, with a doctor, let's just say, not even a spinal surgeon, people tap into this, I'm going to complicate it unnecessarily here. People tap into this network effect that everybody knows what a doctor is, and spinal surgeon, you have at least an idea, even if you don't know exactly. And they're like, oh, okay, that's it. But that doesn't really happen to you because media company can mean many things.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is like, being a spinal surgeon or being a doctor or being a lawyer or working at Google or working at any like big company, Exxon, Microsoft, whatever, is something you can go and explain to your mom and your parents will be proud of you. And, or just anyone thinks, you know, it has some status associated with it. But if you just say you're an entrepreneur or you run a you know, I guess running a company has some, but it's less like, I don't know, normie to say. So it's like, it just doesn't feel like it's worth it.
Yeah.
To put down that, but I could be better at that. I want to be better at that. Yeah.
What do you think keeps you from, if you feel like talking about this, what do you think keeps you from gaining that, what you said, more confidence in telling people what it is that you're doing? Obviously, without going into the full podcast episode when you just met them of, yeah, let me tell you how I started Star Story, but what do you think it is that inhibits your confidence to share that?
I guess I'm like worried that, yeah, I guess that they won't understand it, or they won't, like, it will be like wasting their time. Like, why, like, you don't care about, you know, this specific, like, entrepreneurs and stuff. Other people would care about that, but like, you probably don't understand it, and you don't, and I'm, that's something that I think about too, is like, I don't like to waste people's time. If I have a conversation, this is a podcast where you're interviewing me, but typically when I have a conversation with someone, I want them to talk. I want to ask them questions. I don't really like to dominate a conversation. So I'd rather make it about them and what they do. And not, I'm more of a listener, I guess I would say, than a talker.
Yeah, I have that too. Even though sometimes I do dominate conversations, obviously without planning to do them, if they ask me stuff and I get a bit, I get a bit into that spell of telling a bit about the story, at one point I snap and I say, I know about myself. Tell me about you. I'm here to learn about you. So it's about the same curiosity that we talked about earlier, that I do the same thing, which is, yeah, oh, but what about this? What about that? So people have told me, without knowing I run a podcast, they said, I feel like you just interview me for like a magazine or like a podcast after asking me all these questions. I'm like, well, I've learned a lot about you, so I've gotten something out of it. You too, I guess. Leaving that behind, I want to talk to you as well. I said in the beginning about so-called lifestyle design, which it's a bit of a fancy word, but it speaks into that another buzzword, the work-life balance. And I guess here's a way to put it: feeding your soul, because your soul relates to the business as well. So you said you play tennis. Were you ever that type of person who feels like they have to work all the time, and if they don't work, they feel like they're losing it or something?
Yeah, no, I mean, I still am like that. I still work pretty much all hours. I've definitely gotten better over the last few years, especially when I brought people onto the team that can help. They don't feel like you're doing everything yourself. That really did help a lot. But I would be lying. I mean, I do love playing tennis, and that is almost like my, I guess, like therapy, or like my escape from the work. It's like to be able to do something, and it's so intense that you don't think about it. It's like meditation or running or whatever. You don't think about the other thing. Mm-hmm. You don't think about work. So it's like almost like a release or a break from work. But I am one of the people that will always be working. But I also, I think going back to lifestyle design, is that I try not to, I do put my friends and family and life in front of the business. I guess how I'd explain it is like my business warps around my friends and family and things that I want to do. So it's still always ever present and always something that I'm thinking about, but luckily I'm in a position where I run my own business and I can work around those things. So for example, like my dad just came and visited for the last 2 weeks, and I just didn't work as much. We spent more time together, during the day on weekdays, which, typically you have a 9 to 5. And then, I was able to take a Monday off to go do something, and not be working. So, and I have a lot of thoughts on lifestyle design. I knew that you're going to ask that question. So
yeah,
that's a good part. Yeah.
Let's go through one by one. So have you always been like this? I'm asking actually something else. Have you been through a transition where you had to learn how to balance those things, what you just told me, maybe taking out some time to spend with your dad, or wrapping your business around your friends and family and yourself. Was it always like that? Because the reason why I'm asking is an hour ago, when I've assumed the motivation wrongly, everybody comes with their culture and how they were raised and what they've been exposed to. So for some people, it comes naturally because they've always knew it. For some other people, they knew it the wrong way. They had to unlearn some stuff and then get on the right path. So back to my question, how was it for you? Came natural, go for some friction and had to learn it, learn for the pain. It all comes full circle with all our topics.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm probably like not remembering how bad it was, but I think it was pretty bad in terms of how much I was working. Like, I remember when I first quit my job in New York City. Well, I guess when I first started working on the business and I got so into it that it just consumed me. Like, I stopped going out on the weekends and I was just building it all weekend, all night. It consumed me. I still, you know, would make time, but there are a few moments that I remember that I did skip for the business. Like, for example, a friend's birthday party. I didn't like that. And I remember when I moved home after, I lived with my parents for a few months after I quit, before I went nomad. And my mom tells me that she remembers that I was like, what, how did she say it? She said that I was like, I would almost have like episode, like it seemed like I would like, she'd be like, how did she say it? That I would work for like 24 hours straight and like go to bed at like 6 a.m. and then wake up and do it all again. So for me, it just never felt like, at the time, it never felt like I really enjoyed it. So it didn't feel like burnout at all. But from an outside perspective, I would say that it probably didn't look healthy. So I would say that I'm less like that now, but I can't say that I've figured it out. I think finding other passions and other hobbies is really helpful. Like, what are you going to do when you're not working on your business? If you don't know that, then you might just keep working on your business. So finding something like tennis was really nice because I could, like, it's almost like another business in itself. It's like a skill, and there's all these little aspects of it. And like, I watch a bunch of YouTube videos on it, and I'm like trying to level up. You know, there's all these different like skill levels and different leagues and all this stuff. But if I didn't have that, I'd probably just work a lot.
Did you start looking for something and you found tennis, or did it come, you just stumbled into it? Because it seemed like this is your main outlet for now, at least.
Yeah, yeah. I used to do a lot of running, and I realized, and then I just went and played tennis, and only a couple of years ago that I really started playing, and I really enjoyed it. And then I just, again, it's almost like one of those obsession things I was talking about earlier. It's like, I just became obsessed and I wanted to do it every day, and it became addicting, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
What about, I want to ask you as well, you've mentioned earlier, I stopped going out on the weekends, which, as you just explained, it was just a side effect of the fact that you were so into what you were doing. Do you have, at the moment, maybe hard pointers, maybe a list in your head of stuff that you kind of have to do? I mean, obviously, I never understood the pressure of you have to do something on weekends. If you feel like doing it, do it. If not, don't. But do you have anything else like that that you use to keep yourself in check when it comes to balancing work and life?
Are you asking like what advice I would, like what things you should take out of your life if you want to build a business, or?
I'm asking I'm asking more when it comes to making sure you're balanced. When you look at yourself, you've given this example of weekends. Is there anything else like that? So one that I know for sure you mentioned is having a hobby or something, an outlet outside of work, if you can find it. If not, Godspeed with your work. I think that's what you were saying. Yeah. So anything else other than, maybe you agree, maybe you don't agree with this thing on the weekends, and the hobbies, anything else like that?
I would say that there's this thing called Parkinson's Law, where it basically says work will expand to the time available for its completion. So if you want to get you say you want to launch a product in 2 months, or you want to build a product in 2 months, this law will basically say you'll build that product in 2 months, regardless of if you work on it 8 hours a day or 1 hour a day. So something that I think about a lot is like, you want to get where you're going, you're still going to get there, even if you don't work 12 hours a day and work all day, every day. If you can understand, it took me a while to realize that. But I guess a lot of people that I know, or a lot of workaholics and people that work a lot, especially in like, you know, investment banking and like those sorts of things, it's like the culture of like working like crazy hours. If you can realize that you still like taking breaks is good, and not working is as valuable as working, because when you're not working, you're thinking, you're like reflecting on your work and like what you really should be doing, and like taking a step back. And like, again, like it's important as what you work on is what you don't work on. I don't want to say like that's what you should do, but for me, it's as important as what I work on is what I don't work on. So I say that would be like my most biggest takeaway on balance is like, you're still going to get what you want to get done, whatever your plans in life are. And it won't matter how much you worked. It'll just matter the goals that you set and that you know, were consistent and showed up every day.
I don't know. That's crazy useful, because every time I heard about Parkinson's Law, I looked at it, and I have a feeling this is most people. I always got it the other way, which is don't add more time than you need, because you will expand into doing. But you're saying that it can also contract. So if you allow yourself less time, you're saying you'll still get there.
Yeah, if you want to do something faster, you could. Yeah, it does work that way too.
I always looked into expansion, not contraction. But what about, I'm trying to play the devil's advocate here. What about the people who say, yeah, but if I only spend 30 minutes a day, it can't amount to anything worthwhile doing. So would you say there's also a minimum of time you have to spend into something to balance this?
I don't know if you can really say there's some time amount per day, but just the fact that you're doing something every day, for me at least, is motivation that I probably want to work more than that. So it's really just showing up for like 30 minutes every day will probably motivate you to work on it, you know, 3 hours one day, 4 hours another day. But as long as you're getting that 30 minutes in every day, then that will get you there. That will get you what you're...
Okay, so you're saying that the consistency is also an important part in this, because you might fluctuate between how much time you're spending, but you can see it makes sense now. You still make progress on, you still get there at about the same rate if you keep on doing it, but you don't have to expand into taking more and more time. All right.
I think it's like, for example, in the last couple of weeks, I haven't worked as hard in my business. And like, sometimes I think, well, I used to be a lot worse about this, is like guilt about, you know, not maximizing all my time possible. I think a lot of entrepreneurs have that and they don't talk about it. But I don't think that in the grand scheme that taking a couple weeks off, or sometimes it's even a great thing to do. Like one time I took a week off and I did what's called a think week, where you just like turn off all your phones, all your screens, don't work on anything, and just reflect and go do some writing or whatever. That can, regardless of that, I don't think that... Sorry, there's a crazy storm going on.
Oh, it's actually, I don't know if you heard it as well, but earlier I was smiling because I tried closing the window and it kept pushing back. There is this crazy wind in here in London as well.
It looks like it's dark over here but it's really just a crazy storm coming in. It's in the middle of the day.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Florida, man.
How rare is that? That in both cities is a. I mean, this isn't
Where
really
are
a
you at?
store. Sorry,
Where are you?
London, United
Oh,
Kingdom.
nice.
So in England, yeah. So it's just today that the wind is going like crazy, and you have a storm. That's what I was saying. It's we're synced.
Yeah, it's funny. Different sides of the globe, but same feelings.
Yeah. You were saying about this Think Week you were having, which I'm super curious about.
Yeah, that was the Think Week that I realized that I would sell Pigeon or stop working on it, which it was the best decision that, or it was a very important decision that I don't know if I would have made if I didn't take that time off. It was like a couple months after the pandemic. I was like pretty burnt out from just building two different businesses and trying to make it work. And it was that moment that I realized that I was working, let's say like I was spending like 80% of my time on Pigeon, and it was making like $1,000 a month. And I was spending 20% of my time on Star Story, and it was making like $5,000 a month. So like the Pareto principle there is that I'm putting no time into Star Story, and it's making 80% of the revenue. I'm putting all my time into Pigeons, making 20% of the revenue. So that was like something that I think, looking back, that's how I think about it now. But in the time, in the moment, I was just decided to just drive, just go on like a really long road trip and just drive around the United States. It was like COVID, so you couldn't really fly anywhere. And I just got my car and I just drove around and listened to podcasts and books and did some writing and thinking, and then came back from that and decided that I would stop working on Pigeon and went full 100% into Starter Story. Sorry, my dog is barking there.
No
Went
worries.
full on into Starter Story and stop. No.
Is he making a guest appearance? Let's
Yeah.
have him here. Let's
Hey.
say hi.
Come here. Come on. So then, when I got back from the Think Week and I decided to go full time on Starter Story, that month alone, I think we doubled revenue, or I can't remember the exact numbers, but we went from 5,000 a month, and then within basically a year to a year and a half, went to 30, 40, or 50,000 a month. So that Think Week, just that time, it was really only 7 or 10 days of just not working. I like literally didn't look at email. I didn't do anything. Just did nothing, and that was a big impact. So, time off is as valuable as time on sometimes, I think.
That's super interesting. I just have one last question as we get closer to ending this Think Week. Give us a how to. Is it qu kind of like a meditation, but in the grander scheme of things, so like with a bigger picture, which is when I meditate or when I do something, it feels like meditation. What it feels like is I allow space for what's coming inside of me to come to the surface. So did it feel like that when it came as a ready-made decision, you're saying, selling Pigeon or leaving Pigeon behind, which was your side product. Was it like that, or give us a how to on the Think Week and how to approach this?
Yeah, that's a good question because, in the first day, it was like still in work mode. I was still thinking of like, oh, here are all the tasks I need to do for the day, or here's the things we need to do in the next 2, 3 months. And then on the second day, it was like, a little bit more of that. And like, I was like thinking, because I was still trying to, at the time, the decision wasn't ready made, as you asked. I was still thinking, what do I do? Like, how can I fix this problem? I mean, if I were to give any advice on Think Weeks, it's do it if you're burnt out, especially if you're feeling some sort of burnout. It's a good time to do it. That, at least in my own experience, that was that. So in the second day, I was, saying like, okay, well, like, how can I solve this problem more holistically from a higher level rather than build these things and do these marketing things or whatever? It was more like, what's the actual solution to this problem? And the problem was that I was working on two different businesses, but I didn't realize that at the time. I still thought I was able to make it work with two different businesses. And then on the third day, it started coming to me, and like it almost like came to me like a. It sounds obvious in hindsight, obviously, but at the time, it came to me really kind of slowly over the course of a couple of days. And then the decision felt so, it felt like, so I have to make this decision. It felt so right in the moment that it wasn't hard to make that decision at all. It just came to me, probably because I wasn't working and wasn't thinking so much about work and wasn't distracted by Twitter or these other things. And I just had, and I think it's the fact that I was driving so much was helpful because I couldn't really like distract myself with social media or anything. I was just really just sitting there listening to music or listening to nothing or, and yeah, it just came to me. And then I can't explain anything other than it felt right in the moment, and it felt like instinct almost. And it wasn't hard to make that decision after that.
I need to do that too. You just enabled this within me as a task to have a think week, or at least to maybe not even with a special purpose as you had, but see what happens when you take a bit of distance from work like that. Fantastic stuff, man. I feel like it's super helpful. I know for sure it helped me. We can't hear what the audience has to say because this isn't live yet, but it will be. So if you listen to this, do let us know what you thought about this. Pat Wolves, very, very happy to have had you. I feel like this was super fun, and I feel like we could have talked about, we didn't even touch upon SEO or so many other topics, but maybe.
So I can come back on another time, hopefully.
Yeah, you know what they say, when you travel to some place and you have this list of things you want to see, don't go to all of them so that you have a reason to come for a second time. Same here. We have a reason for our part two. Where should people keep in touch with you, and where would you like to direct them to know more about you?
Yeah. Starter Story, obviously, as we talked about, is my main business. You can just search Starter Story on Google. And that'll come up. And then I'm sort of active on Twitter. And so if you just search Pat Wolves Twitter, it should come up. And in there, I have a link to my personal blog, which I still haven't been writing enough on there lately. But if you're interested in some of that, I used to write every day. So you can go and see my blog, and especially some of those things they talked about today, like me going through those decisions, like especially even in the Think Week, I wrote about that every day. That patwalls.com, or it's linked in my Twitter bio, so you can see that. But yeah,
that's it then. I'll stop the recording in a second, Pat. Thank you again for the patience, for the knowledge you shared here, and we'll see you for a part two then.
Thank you, man. That was a great conversation.